Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. The 2023 session of the Utah Legislature concluded last week. We're going to review what the legislature did, from banning gender-affirming health care for transgender minors to passing a new school vouchers law. And we'll ask, did the legislature do enough to save the Great Salt Lake? Joining me today are Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Water and land use reporter Leah Larson is with us. Thank you.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Real estate reporter Tony Semerad. Thank you.
Hi, everybody.
And news columnist Robert Gerke. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. Well, let's start with Emily Anderson Stern, State Watch reporter. So the 45-day session, it's quite a sprint. I think it's 30-some-odd days, actually, if you don't count weekends. So thanks to all of you for your great coverage. Let's start with transgender health care. This Senate Bill 16, I think, passed fairly early in the session.
Yeah, it did. And, you know, a lot of the more controversial bills this session were front-loaded. So you had big groups coming up to the Capitol and making their voices heard on those issues.
Tell me, remind us what Senate Bill 16 does.
So Senate Bill 16, it essentially indefinitely bans a lot of gender-affirming health care for transgender youth. One thing that, you know, there was another bill that would have done that as well, but this bill has a study built in. So the Department of Health and Human Services, as part of this bill, will look at data about how hormone treatments impact young people. But the thing is, there's no deadline for that study to be finished. So that essentially makes the ban indefinite, and we have no idea when that ban might be re-examined.
As you say, the ban took effect immediately. The Governor Cox signed it, right?
Right.
Also blocks body-altering surgeries, I think, right?
Yep. Pretty much all gender-affirming care.
What were the, Senator Kennedy and others who supported this measure, why did they say it was needed?
So, you know, a lot of the arguments were that people are saying we really don't know how some of these treatments are impacting these kids long term, impacting their health. And people brought up, you know, what if these kids change their minds? They're not old enough to make these decisions. But then, you know, in public comment, there were a lot of people who came and testified about how young they were when they knew they were transgender. People who were saying, you know, there were young people saying that this gender-affirming care, hormone treatments, whatever, saved their lives. You know, they were struggling with mental health problems prior to receiving that care. And that gender-affirming care is really, really what helped them get to a better place.
So as the ban is in place, it'll be indefinite, and there'll be a study happening, I guess is the bottom line.
Right.
Let's move to education. I guess the big headline here was the legislature tied a school voucher program to a salary increase for teachers, right?
Right. And I want to give a shout out to my colleague, Courtney Tanner, who did a lot of great work on education issues this session and really helped us out by stepping up to this. But
yeah, wonderful. Yeah, she did a great job on that. So House Bill 215... does give a raise to teachers, $6,000 or so. But tied it to the school voucher program, I think generally teachers were not happy with this.
Yeah, you know, at the beginning, this was one of the earliest big bills in the session. And as it was being debated, you see a lot of public teachers up there, you know, every day in red, really protesting this bill. And then you see, you know, a lot of people coming up in school choice, like t-shirts that promote school choice. You know, there were a lot of kids from private schools who were bussed up, a lot of homeschool families who came up. So it really drew a lot of crowds to the Capitol.
So proponents of the bill were saying we need more choice. Parents need more choice, right?
Right. So the bill, it created like what a scholarship program essentially for people who want choices outside the public school system, including private schools and homeschools. To give about for students who apply and receive that scholarship, they get about $8,000 each, which is higher than, the amount that public schools get per student in the state of Utah. And so that program will get about $42 million.
I know, remember when we discussed this with Courtney a few weeks back, her story pointed out that some opponents of this bill are saying the existing scholarship voucher programs are not fully utilized.
Right. So there are some narrower scholarship programs currently in place, but those funds a lot of times sit there unused. And Courtney, had a great story on that.
They'll just mention briefly, there are a couple other education bills mentioned in this story. House Bill 477, full-day kindergarten programs available to districts with some money for that, right?
Right, and that's something that some lawmakers have been trying to do for years. So a lot of people in Utah who have been pushing for this for a long time saw this as a pretty big victory.
And House Bill 308 does away with assigning a single letter grade to each of Utah's public schools. I guess that program had been in place for a while, right?
Yeah, and that's one that's been pretty controversial. It was based on standardizing exams, and so there are a lot of questions about the fairness of that, especially for schools where, a lot of students, English is their second language, so standardized exams really don't reflect what those students are learning because they're not really written with people from whose second language is English in mind. There are a lot of questions about really how those the numbers on standardized exams actually reflect teachers' performance. So.
Let's talk about abortion restrictions. This is, you did a lot of great reporting on this during the session. In this section, you say that you remind us that since the abortion trigger law was potentially went into effect after the Dobbs decision, that was blocked by a district court, and the legislature did not like that injunction.
Yeah, and, you saw last fall, Representative Carrie Ann Lizabee and Representative Kara Berkland getting a bunch of other lawmakers to sign on to these letters that they sent out to healthcare providers who are providing abortions, essentially threatening them with prosecution if they don't adhere to the trigger law, which is being blocked in court. And then, the Legislative Management Committee voted to send a somewhat rare amicus brief to the Supreme Court on that injunction, asking for it to be lifted. And then, Representative Brady Brammer at the beginning of the session put forward HDR 2, which gives the Attorney General's office another tool to potentially get rid of that injunction. Right now, the Attorney General's office is appealing the injunction and what's called an interlocutory appeal before the Supreme Court. And, they'll probably wait that out, see what the Supreme Court says. But if they don't end the injunction, then that's when you could potentially see the Attorney General's office use HJR2, which changes the rules on when a court can issue an injunction and would allow the Attorney General's office to specifically ask the courts, will you look at this injunction again under these new rules?
Representative, you quote Representative Bramner as saying the trigger law was the trigger to his joint resolution. But this is opponents of this are saying this is too broad.
Well, it initially would have affected, the joint resolution is retroactive and would have affected a lot of areas of law in the state. And, you had the Utah Bar complaining about it and lots of attorneys complaining about it. So they ended up actually substituting the bill and making it so the retroactive clause would only impact lawsuits which are challenging laws passed by the legislature. So it really targeted, in that sense, the trigger law, because the only law right now that's enjoined under the language that they're targeting is the abortion trigger law. And Brady Brammer also said that changing these rules would make it harder for the Supreme Court in the future, or for courts in the future in general in Utah, to enjoin any laws passed by the legislature, especially controversial ones.
Tell me about House Bill 467. This, am I reading this right? This would phase out abortion clinics. Under this law, at a certain point, there would be no abortion clinics in Utah?
Right. So the state will stop. Governor Cox has said he will sign this. And so under this, the state would stop giving licenses to abortion clinics in May. And abortion clinics will stop operating either whenever their licenses expire or in January 2024, whichever comes first.
And I guess so that would mean if you want an abortion, you have to go to the hospital.
Most likely. And, you know, throughout debate, Representative Lisenby and the Senate sponsor, Senator Dan McKay, were saying, well, you know, the state definition of the hospital also includes medical clinics that can offer like the same level of care. But a lot of, people, abortion rights advocates, especially people who run these abortion clinics, were saying, well, that's not really a standard we'll be able to meet. And really, we don't know of any clinics that would meet that. So these abortions most likely would be in hospitals.
There's some other provisions in House Bill 467, right? What else would it do?
So the bill is more than 1,000 lines long. So it's really, there are a lot of things it would do, but we're really not sure of the entirety of the impacts. We do know that it limits abortion access for victims of rape and incest to 18 weeks. We know that it will make violating Utah's abortion laws unprofessional conduct for healthcare providers. And it also requires, so one of the exceptions in the abortion trigger law is for fatal fetal abnormalities, but this law requires doctors to explain to women who are considering abortion for a fetus that has a fatal abnormality, explain to them options for perinatal hospice and palliative care as alternatives to abortion. So they would give birth to this child and essentially watch it in a hospital-like setting until the child passes away.
It's interesting. At a certain point, I'm assuming the injunction will be lifted, the trigger law will go into effect, but there have been a lot of changes in the meantime. The landscape has shifted.
Yeah, we'll see what happens with the trigger law, but there's this bill, and then also Representative Kara Berkland put forth a bill that also did the same thing as Representative Lisenby's, that cuts off abortion for victims of rape and incest to 18 weeks. And Berkland's also requires doctors to, so under the trigger law, if you're a victim of rape or incest, you have to report to law enforcement before you can seek an abortion. And Berkland's bill requires doctors to document how they're verifying those reports have been made. So those are some of the changes that have been made since Roe v. Wade was reversed in June. We'll see what happens. And Planned Parenthood and the ACLU have both said that lawsuits against the recently passed bills are not off the table.
So we may see some lawsuits coming, yeah. There were several bills regarding pregnant women in healthcare. House Bill 54, what would this do?
I'm sorry, you'll have to remind me of the name.
A tax credit for pregnant women.
So House Bill 54, so that's the big tax bill. So there are a lot of tax credits, changes to taxes within there. Representative Lisenby, in Governor Cox's budget, he'd included a tax credit for pregnant people. And Representative Lisenby initially put forth a bill that would provide that tax credit. Now that tax credit, essentially what it does is in the year a child is born, the parents get a tax credit for it. So the child is counted as a child before they're born. And, you know, a lot of people say this helps parents, this helps pay for all of the costs of having a newborn. But some people who are like abortion advocates and advocates for pregnant people are worried that this would create another place in Utah code where a fetus is considered a person and would give set a precedent where there can be more abortion restrictions and pregnant people can be held accountable for things that happen to their fetus. Like if, you know, they're doing something that would be considered reckless and the fetus dies. But that bill, Lisenby's bill, was later wrapped into the tax bill, HB 54. So it was part of that bigger bill.
There is Senate Bill 133 apparently would extend Medicaid postpartum coverage from 60 days to a full year. That's a big change.
That is. And that's something, you know, there's a little bit of pushback against that because lawmakers usually aren't too big fans of expanding Medicaid. But this is one where, you know, where without access to abortion, there will likely be more pregnant people giving birth. And so there'll be more access to healthcare. But also, you know, this is something that researchers have said reduces maternal mortality rates. A lot of times when people who give birth pass away, it's within a year of giving childbirth. And so having access to Medicaid and that healthcare afterward really improves the outcomes there.
Let's just mention briefly, you doing this story, Senator Escamilla's Senate Bill 192, I think, would have failed. That would have covered doulas.
Right. And again, with the Medicaid, Sophia Jeremias helped out a lot with this. And yeah, it would have expanded Medicaid to doulas. The interesting thing is, you know, that bill had a lot of support in the Senate. I believe it was a unanimous vote. And then the House just... They killed it. So we'll see what could happen in future years. But for now, doulas are not accessible as part of Medicaid in Utah.
Well, thanks for all that legislative coverage. I just want to mention very briefly, we're running out of time for the segment, but you, along with Associated Press, had a story recently on we've heard that Walgreens will not sell the abortion pill in states where the attorneys general have objected, right? So that includes Utah. Tell me briefly about this.
Yeah, so Attorney General Sean Reyes has been pretty vocal in his access to and in his opposition to one of the two pills that people are given when they're seeking an abortion, a medicated abortion. And this one in particular is mifepristone. And, you know, he sent a letter both to the FDA and to Walgreens, and he joined other attorneys general in sending a letter to Walgreens and CVS saying, the one to the FDA, he expressed disappointment that they changed their rules earlier this year to allow those pills to be accessed by mail. And then the letter to Walgreens and CVS essentially threatens legal action if they go forward with a plan to dispense that pill by mail. And so Walgreens said, well, if you're threatening legal action, we're actually not going to move forward with any plans at all to sell it in the 20 states who signed attorneys general signed on to those letters. So, you know, even though in several of these states, including Utah, these pills are still legal, Walgreens will not be selling them either through the mail or in its brick and mortar stores.
And other drug stores, according to the story, are studying the issue, right? Rite Aid and CVS and others, Walmart. And you end the story. Legal experts foresee years of court battles over access to the pills, which I imagine is probably likely. Emily Anderson Stern, thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Hope you stay with us for your Unplayed Story of the Week later in the program. So, Robert Gerke, that's a lot of bills to talk about. What comment on a couple of those, maybe?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, as you mentioned, as Emily mentioned, the beginning of the session started pretty fast and furious with the transgender bill and the school voucher bill. I mean, the thing that she pointed out with the transgender bill that I think is really troubling is that this does impose an immediate and complete ban on you know, hormone treatment. And under the pretense that we're going to do a Utah-specific study, and there are dozens of studies that have been done on this issue, all of them point in the same direction, that this is, on the whole, beneficial for these people who are going through gender dysphoria. And to, you know, ban it completely, and after the hearing all of this testimony from all of these Utah parents and Utah, you know, kids or adults who have gone through this, I think is really, you know, kind of hard to comprehend. You know, they kind of dressed it up with surgery for young kids, but surgery doesn't, they don't do surgery on young kids. That's not sort of the medically accepted standard. And so, you know, it's one of these issues that's being driven by a lot of fear and not necessarily the facts or any kind of compassion. And so I think that's disappointing, and we don't know how long that study's going to take, and you know, we'll wait and see, I guess. But for a lot of families who have kids who are find themselves in this situation, I think it's a real setback for them. The voucher bill, as was pointed out, they packaged this unpopular idea. Vouchers have never really had broad public support. They packaged that with the teacher's raise, that, you know, to try to divide the opposition, I guess, in some respect, and that worked. We'll see how that plays out. It doesn't necessarily help a lot of people. We're talking about less than 5,000 people statewide. And, you know, it also, if we have the same experience that we've seen in other states, we're talking about 75 to 90% of those kids who are going to take advantage of it are already in private schools. So it's a benefit for private schools or, you know, charter schools that want to become private schools, perhaps, but doesn't really do much in the way of helping public education in our public school system. You know, we could go on and on, I guess, go run down the list. I mean, the abortion stuff, not at all surprising that they're trying to do more in the wake of the Dobbs decision. Again, I don't know that they're asking or approaching this from the standpoint of how can we find a good solution that works for women who find themselves in a, you know, in a precarious situation. And we've never really put restrictions on, for example, you know, women who are victims of rape or incest, but now I guess we are going to do that. You know, the restricting of the access or limiting it to hospitals only. I mean, that becomes potentially problematic. We don't really know, and they don't know either, but they went ahead and made the policy anyway. But it's hospitals presumably are going to be a lot more expensive. There are questions about if, you know, insurance is going to cover it or not. And you know, there are questions about whether or not doctors and hospitals are even going to be willing to perform these. And they put all of these, because they put with it criminal penalties, potential criminal penalties, if they don't, you know, follow the letter of the law. So it's, you know, it was you can sense a trend, I think, overall in this session, you know, where they're passing laws sort of based on a notion, I guess, a fear of these things that is being driven a lot, I think, by sort of a national agenda or a competition among red states to see which ones can be the most punitive on these particular issues. And it's a real trend that we saw this session, I think.
Well, let's head toward a break. We're overdue for a break here. We're recapping the legislative session on Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCBW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. And when we come back, we'll take a look at water issues. What did the legislature do regarding the Great Salt Lake and water in general? And we'll be talking with water and land use reporter Leah Larson. More following this break.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. We're recapping the 2023 session of the Utah Legislature. We turn next to water and land use reporter from the Salt Lake Tribune, Leah Larson. Leah, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of things happened in the legislature regarding water in the Great Salt Lake, and you were there to cover it. Let's start with... in your story you make reference to this. Even though this winter has brought epic snowpack, this could take many good water years to pull the region out of the mega drought, right?
That is true. I was looking at the snow survey data this morning, and the state is at 161% of its average snowpack, which is pretty amazing. And we still have 24 days until the period when our snowpack typically peaks. So yeah, it's been a pretty banner year. However, I've compared some of these snowpack figures to previous years that were big, like 2017, 2011. And even with these big snowpacks, the lake usually just kind of rises by a blip. So it will take several years, like in the 80s, when we had all that flooding. And I think people are pretty aware of that. That was like when the Great Salt Lake reached its highest point. But that was after like several years of like just incredible snowpack, incredible snowfall. So 1 year is not enough to get us out of this ecological and like public health disaster that's looming.
So you write in the story, policymakers and water managers are miffed that Utah's constantly trashed as being one of the most wasteful water users. It sounds like Senate Bill 119 is a bit of pushback on this.
Yes. I mean, Utah is constantly dinged as being one of the most wasteful water users per capita. I mean, even John Oliver made fun of us like a year or two ago. And I think water managers kind of bristle at that notion because other Western states, what they do is they take their water consumption per capita, per person, and then they credit themselves back for the water that they return to the environment. And Utah, you know, we're doing the same thing. We're treating wastewater and we're putting it in streams or we're putting it back in the Great Salt Lake. But we're not crediting ourselves back for that. So I think they're going to retool that. So maybe we don't look quite as bad compared to our neighboring states, but we'll see. We'll see how that plays out.
Senate Bill 118 would put more money in the turf buyback program, I think.
Yeah, so it kind of loops in some of these big water districts to be partners in the existing state's turf buyback program. But I think what was interesting about this bill is initially, like the first draft of the bill, they had proposed, so there's incentives for you to rip out your grass and put in, you know, more desert friendly or water wise landscaping. So what happens if you sell your house and a new homeowner buys it and is like, I'm going to put grass back there? So the bill had initially provided like a tax lien, so you would have to pay back the state if you did that. But that was wiped out of the bill as it progressed through the session, which I think is kind of interesting.
Let's see, House Bill 217 would create a pilot program to help school districts, I think, to be more water wise. Is that what it is?
Yes. And this bill was sponsored by Representative Galen Bennion, who is a Democrat based in Cottonwood Heights. And it seemed like this one was not going to make it because it had a really, really big fiscal note. It was going to cost the state a lot of money. So I didn't think this one was going to pass, actually, but she revised it a few times and turned it into a pilot program. So what it is going to do is some of our more urban school districts have been able to take advantage of grants and money out there to install like smart sensor sprinklers so they're not overwatering their grass and maybe take out grass in places where it doesn't make sense and also monitor their energy consumption and improve that. But rural school districts don't really have access to that kind of money or, you know, the manpower, the human power to do some of those projects. So this pilot program will allow some of the schools to take advantage of state funding and federal funding to participate in similar programs. They're going to give preference to schools within the Great Salt Lake Basin, which is also interesting.
The Speaker Wilson has talked about waterways, and House Bill 307 has to do with this. What is waterways?
I think there's a bit of skepticism out there about this bill. It's supposed to be like what UCARE did for air quality. It's going to be, you know, that version, but for water. So it's going to be educating people about conservation. It's going to be leveraging public-private partnerships to do some water conservation projects. But I think a lot of people looked at this bill and kind of raised an eyebrow and was like, well, we're already doing a lot of this in the state, so why is this needed? But I think when you have someone as powerful as a speaker behind it, it's hard to like not get in line. But I don't know if this is going to make a difference or if it's just kind of redundant, but we shall see.
Let's see. House Bill 513 sets an emergency trigger that apparently would halt mineral extractors at a certain level. Tell me about this.
Yeah, so I think this is probably one of the most significant bills for the Great Salt Lake to emerge this session, actually. I think a lot of people, Senator Nate Bluen had proposed a bill that would set a target. Well, it wasn't even a bill. It was like a resolution, so no teeth, but would have set a target elevation that the Great Salt Lake should rise to maintain its health. And that didn't even make it out of committee. And I think a lot of people were disappointed. But this bill does something pretty similar. Instead of a target elevation, it has a salinity trigger. So if the salinity concentrations in the Great Salt Lake get too high, where it's threatening brine shrimp and brine flies and those foundational species in the lake that support industry and birds, then the mineral extraction companies have to stop siphoning away brine. The state has to use the railway causeway berm that kind of splits the lake in two to manage salinity to ensure the south arm at least remains viable, even if the north arm does not. And you know, I think if we all remember back to U.S. Magnesium, how they wanted to extend their intake canals so they could continue taking like 100,000 gallons per minute for their operation, I think that really alarmed a lot of people. So this bill really addresses that and says, no, you can't do that if the lake is in the dire straits it's in right now.
House Bill 491 would create a Great Salt Lake czar. That's my word. It's great. Great Salt Lake commissioner. Why is this needed, according to the sponsor?
Yeah, czar is an apt descriptor, I think. I was a little confused by this one. I haven't had a good answer on this, but Speaker Brad Wilson had initially floated the idea of a Great Salt Lake Authority, which to me suggests like a board of people making decisions. But when this bill came out, it was like that power was concentrated within the hands of a single person. And I'm not sure why, but the idea is there are so many state agencies that manage aspects of the lake, like the Division of Wildlife manages the brine shrimp and the birds. The Division of Forestry, Fire, and State Lands manages the lake's lake bed. The Division of Water Quality manages the lake's water quality. The Division of Water Resources manages water quantity, and on and on and on. So, like, these people are all doing great work for the lake, but they're not necessarily unified or always talking to each other. So this commissioner is supposed to be kind of the unifying voice and actually has some authority to make big decisions for the lake. And with this, they're supposed to conduct some kind of study as to what to do with the lake moving forward, which is kind of confusing because it seems like they're already doing that. So I think it just kind of remains to be seen what will come of this, why it's needed, why it's not a, you know, an authority versus a single commissioner. And I know there was like a lot of concern among certain groups when this bill first emerged that public records law were going to be like lax for this. But I sat down with Utah Water Rights attorney Emily Lewis, who's very smart and knows a lot about this stuff. And we went over it line by line. And I don't really think there's much reason to be alarmed. I mean, of course, I'm always going to advocate for more transparency versus less. But this bill just, it seems pretty tame. Basically, the public records restrictions would be regarding kind of like when your local city council has to go into closed session to discuss like a real estate purchase. They don't want to give anybody an unfair advantage to come out and scoop that from under them. So it's kind of like that, but for like water rights and water leases. So I don't think there's much reason to be concerned as far as that goes, but
we'll see. Let's mention one more bill that you cover in your story here. House Bill 349. This is interesting. Treated municipal wastewater, I guess this bill would ensure that flows to the lake, is it? Why is this, why are they wanting to guarantee that?
Yeah, good question. So one of the kind of paradoxes with the Great Salt Lake is, you know, we're getting all these conservation messages where, you know, conserve water, and that's great for outdoors on your landscape, but indoors, when you're brushing your teeth or, you know, taking a shower, That water flows to a wastewater treatment plant where it's treated and put back into rivers or the Great Salt Lake itself, rivers that flow to the Great Salt Lake or the lake itself. So it's some of the only water actually guaranteed to make it to the lake. So this bill would ensure that it stays that way, basically, because as we're facing water shortages across the West, a lot of water providers and water managers are looking at treated affluent as a new source of maybe outdoor water use, or even treating it to standards that could use it for drinking water again. And that could potentially be really bad for the lake. But, you know, I think water districts were maybe caught a little off guard by this bill, and I don't know that they're 100% on board, but interesting piece of legislation.
We're just about out of time for this segment, about 30 seconds for this. So it just mention this. You have a story out. The headline is, a politician came up with this Great Salt Lake tree thinning idea, not scientists. Give me your 30-second version of this story.
How do you cram this into 30 seconds? Yeah, so as I was listening into like committee hearings and things about water, this idea of like we should chop down all, like a bunch of trees in the Wasatch to save the Great Salt Lake because trees guzzle water, it just kept popping up and we were like, where is this coming from? So we traced it back and it seems to have originated with a county council member who sent this letter to the governor and legislative leadership, but with this fact sheet, which was like kind of poorly researched. Like it relied on blogs in the South and the East, which have different climates and different trees. And it ignored all this other evidence that was kind of contrary to that notion. Like actually, if you cut down a bunch of trees in our watersheds, it could be bad for the Great Salt Lake. Is that a good enough summary?
That is, yeah. I'll urge people to go to sltrib.com and read that. It's very interesting. Thank you so much for all your coverage and for talking about it with us. This Leah Larson, water and land use reporter with Salt Lake Tribune.
Yeah, thanks for your interest.
So Robert Gerke, all these water bills, especially the Great Salt Lake, is this going to have the effect? I guess one of the headlines earlier was, did the legislature do enough?
I don't know that it's possible for them to do enough. It is a crisis situation, and they took some positive steps. And one of the bills that I think is maybe going to make the most difference is they allocated $200 million for agricultural optimization. And, you know, this is where we need to be focusing a lot of our efforts, is on agriculture. It's 3/4 of the water used in the state. And so we can talk all we want about whether or not we're going to water our lawns or let them yellow. But really, that's a drop in the lake. We've really got to focus on our agricultural uses. And so potentially this has, there's an opportunity there to have a pretty good impact. Some of the things they didn't do, they're even simple reporting stuff. I think one of the things that we need to see more of in the state is some standardization of reporting. So, you know, as Leah mentioned, the water districts always push back or get upset when it's reported that Utah uses more per capita than other states, but what they don't really have an alternative. They can't really explain to us why that is, because we don't have a standardized reporting system across the states. And I think stuff like that is stuff we need. And there was a bill that was supposed to focus on reporting how much water golf courses use, and that bill got killed. So there's a bill that would have changed the way property taxes are used to fund big water projects. That's got pushed into a study. We might see it next year, but there was considerably more that they could have done. I think there are some of these steps that could have potential impacts, the benefits to them, but I think there were some missed opportunities as well.
Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter to talk about housing issues at the legislature. And you're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. More following this.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Tom Williams from Utah Public Radio. We turn next to Salt Lake Tribune real estate reporter Tony Semerad. Tony, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
So you cover, of course, real estate, housing. Affordable housing is a real problem in many areas of the state. What are some of the bills that stood out to you that legislature either considered or passed in this area?
Well, yeah, as if there weren't enough tax and major social issues before the legislature, housing continues to dominate their agenda. Just a flurry of spending and policy bills. I would probably highlight a trio of bills that bubbled up from discussion over the course of the interim. The state, for about 4 years, I believe, 4 or 5 years, the state has had a standing commission that on housing affordability that's generating these ideas. And this trio of bills kind of rolled back a lot of controls, if you will, that cities have on what development looks like under the umbrella of quote unquote reducing regulatory barriers. There were a lot of tweaks to a kind of a report card system that the city or that the state maintains for cities in terms of how they're addressing moderate housing. And then, of course, there were huge infusions of money into various aspects of the problem, including a funding for deeply affordable housing and a substantial boost in what are called low-income tax credits at the state level, which are discounts for developers and investors that want to get into affordable housing to kind of make all that happen.
There were a couple of bills that we talked to you, I think maybe just last week on. There's a bill that appeared which would alter how vacation homes are, rules for vacation homes. How did that one fare?
Yeah, that one passed. It's an interesting sort of small slice on the bigger issue of short-term rentals. In a lot of Utah communities, this has really become an issue in terms of how much of the overall housing stock that's available to local, you know, residents and workforce, you know, kind of tenants, how much of that is available to them as opposed to what's being rented on sites like Airbnb and VRBO. And this was a relatively narrow part of that dealt with homes that are owned by a number of co-owners, vacation homes that have a number of owners, so-called fractional ownership. And a couple of the tourist communities like Moab and Park City had stepped into trying to get a handle on where these homes are located and starting to adjust their zoning to kind of maybe limit where they were located. And the legislature under the auspices of property rights has sort of stepped in and limited how they, to what extent they can do that.
There's another story. Again, we talked to you, I think it was just last week, the week before, Senator McKay's bill, 228, which would, I guess, in his view, make it get more information, remove some of the tax burden off of homeowners and onto commercial real estate. How did that one do?
Well, that and its companion bill, which involved a constitutional amendment to prevent the taxes on real estate transactions, both died in the oblivion of rules committees. Those had both emerged relatively late in the session and had to do with this idea of how the tax base is balanced between residential homeowners whose sales data is widely available through, you know, their real estate agents and that sort of thing. How much of the share of the property tax they're bearing based on the assessed value versus commercial properties, which are under Utah's non-disclosure laws, are able to keep sales prices hidden or you know, those are not public. So it seeks to rebalance that. I suspect now that those bills failed, we'll go into another interim of heavy discussion on this property assessment issue.
I'll just mention here, because I want to get to another story that you have here, and then we need to get to underplayed stories. I'll just mention House Bill 499 would make adjustments to the state's homelessness response program and create a Code Blue response. as well. You can check those bills out as well. Just maybe your 30-second version of your story, micro apartments. This is, I guess, one piece of the puzzle to helping with the housing crisis.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen this a broader trend, especially in the kind of rental space along the Wasatch Front of kind of smaller and smaller living spaces. A lot of exploration into the tiny homes field and this. Today's look was an interesting new apartment complex that's opened in the Ballpark neighborhood that's got micro apartments, and they've put 140 units, I believe, most of them subsidized to be more affordable. And it's kind of an interesting look at how that fits into the neighborhood and how they kind of put that project together. It's called Colony B in the Ballpark neighborhood, and that's in today's Salt Lake Tribune.
All right, check that out. It's sltrib.com. Real estate reporter Tony Semrad, thank you.
You bet.
So just briefly, Robert Gerke, what do you have to say about the stories on housing?
Well, I think some of the stuff they did on affordable housing is encouraging. Particularly, there's a tax credit that I think will help get some of these projects moving or make it easier to get them moving. And, there's no easy fix for some of these issues. It took us years to get into this hole that we're in terms of the need for affordable housing, so it's going to take us years to get out. But, this will help move us in that direction, I think, a little bit. The fractional housing thing, I think, is troubling because, once again, the legislature always talks about local control. And when locals try to do something to address their own particular housing needs or problems, they often get rolled. Particularly in these resort towns, you're talking about homes in Park City that the average home price is over $3.5 million. It's hard for people to buy those on their own, and then they're outbid by these companies that come in and snatch them up and use them as short-term rental properties or, timeshare type of situations. And so, they were trying to address that, and the only way they had at their disposal, and the legislature told them they couldn't do it. So I think, once again, local control doesn't matter that much in some of these instances.
Well, we need to get to underplayed stories of the week. So let's start with Emily Anderson Stern. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Mine is one from Jordan Miller about another bill lawmakers passed that would strip collective bargaining rights from Utah Transit Authority managers and supervisors. And the U.S. Department of Labor wrote a letter to the legislature saying that this could put in jeopardy hundreds of millions of dollars in grants from the federal government. And that's a big deal as UTA is looking to make a lot of big changes with its transit and big improvements. So without that money, who knows where those improvements will end up.
All right, check that out at sltrib.com. And go next to Leah Larson. What's your underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, mine is by my colleague, Jacob Scholl, who has been doing a great job covering this gondola proposal up Little Cottonwood Canyon. So the leaders of ALTA sent a letter to the governor's office and to UDOT saying, before you even consider this gondola, how about fixing the gridlock in our town? Because apparently it's a lot easier to get out of the canyon if you're at Snowbird versus ALTA, and they're just having all kinds of traffic problems. So it's a great story, a great scoop. Check it out.
And a shout out to our partnership, Utah Public Radio and Salt Lake Tribune. We're sharing Jacob Scholl, so he's reporting for both of us. Yeah, so
good note.
That's a great thing. Let's go to Tony Semrad, your underplayed story of the week.
I am going to recommend a piece by colleagues Jordan Miller and Blake Apgard on a bill that is likely to dissolve the Unified Police Department here in the Valley, an institution it appears that has run out of its timely usefulness, and cities like Holiday and Midvale and Mill Creek will be looking for new law enforcement services between now and 2025. It's a great piece.
Oh, great. Thank you. SLTrib.com for that story. Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week.
One more legislative bill, or I guess two stories, actually. One of them, obviously, we probably heard that Utah got a new state flag with this past session, and it's a couple years in the works, but there was some opposition to it. So Brian Schott, my colleague Brian Schott, reported this week that opponents of the new Utah state flag are trying to get a ballot referendum going to repeal the new flag. They've got to gather about 130,000 signatures in a fairly short period of time, and they've got to be dispersed all across the state. So the odds are long that they'll actually get that on the ballot. But, you know, their fight against the new woke flag continues.
Some are calling it the woke flag. I hadn't heard that. So we'd have about 30 seconds ish time to get to this. Robert Gerke, your piece on "Has Utah Lost Its Utah Way?" You talked to former Governor Herbert about this. I guess he has some concern. You have some concerns that Utah's losing its Utah way.
You know, I had concerns about it. I don't know that the governor necessarily did. I talked to him about what the Utah way represents in his mind. But we saw this session a whole influx of new rookie freshman members who are really strident in their views and their political views. And what I felt like I saw this year was an unwillingness to kind of sit down and work things out. You know, it's just we saw this in the past on issues like immigration, LGBTQ discrimination, and other issues that have come up in the past, where there's this willingness to enact the Utah way, which is a collaborative approach. And that's what I talked to the governor about. It just seems like that was missing this year. And I don't see it coming back just because of the new blood in the legislature doesn't really have an interest in doing that. They're more strident and they're more partisan and more ideologically driven. And it concerns me a little bit because, you know, we've liked to think of ourselves as special in the past and we're in danger of losing that.
All right. We'll leave it there. We've been talking with Emily Anderson-Stern, Leah Larson, Tony Semerad, and Robert Gerke. Thanks, everyone.